the Senate Committee on Commerce for this afternoon. We have three bills that are scheduled for a public hearing and possible work session. The first one we're going to be taking up is Senate Bill 835. Senator Walker is here. Mm-hmm. And did you want the Wahlbergers to come up with you? Or did?
Yes.
Okay. So Greg and Cammie, if y'all would be so kind to come on up to the table, that'd be wonderful. Yes, and we're going to let Anna do our presentation of the overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 835 requires the Management Labor Advisory Committee to study the adequacy of workers' compensation death benefits. It has no revenue impact, and I just received no fiscal impact today.
Oh, that's music to my ears. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and with me are Mr. and Mrs. Wahlberger, and I'm going to have them talk to you about why they're here, and tragically. And I believe it's my understanding that the Management Labor Advisory Committee has approved Senate Bill 835, not that I really care, but... But they have agreed to support it, which is a good thing. But, Mr. Chair, I've had a number, and members of the committee, I've had a number of constituents over the years who have expressed concern about the death benefit under the workers' comp statute. Folks have, I know one person in particular has been angry because his daughter was killed, and it was later found there was an OSHA violation, and he simply got $5,000, and he was quite angry that his daughter's life was only worth $5,000. So he has been pretty persistent about trying to change the statutes in Oregon, and there are others who have suffered similar tragedies. Ms. Wahlberger communicated with me during the interim and asked if we could make some change to the law. It's a very complex area, the workers' comp law, and as I was working on it, it became clear that it was going to take a great deal more time. So I chose to study the issue. Sometimes that's the easy way out. In this particular case, it's not the easy way out. It's actually the best way to do it. And it was my understanding the Management Labor Advisory Committee had actually been thinking about this themselves, so I think that is why they're not opposed to this legislation. So with that, unless you have any questions, I'd like to turn over to the Wahlbergers.
We'll hear from them first.
Okay.
Okay. I'm Cammie Wahlberger, and
I'm Greg.
And our daughter Brooke was abducted and murdered while she was working in May of 2004 in Corvallis, Oregon. We want to thank you just for listening to our little story here. First of all, I want you to know that our case is closed with workers' comp, so we don't have anything to gain from this or anything. But we just want to kind of share with you what we went through and how that process worked. At first, we were denied because we had waited too long. And in a murder case, sometimes, and especially in this case, the evidence wasn't there. We weren't sure whether she was murdered and how long it took. And then they decided that they would hear the case. And then they decided that because she was single and we were not dependent upon her salary, that there was no claim. And so they then settled the case, and we've received information, and it's been published that workers' comp has settled with the Wahlbergers. And we just wanted you to know what the settlement was. It was that they paid the attorney fee, and they would pay funeral expenses, which were non-applicable in our case. So it was really essentially zero. And they said they were sorry, but that's the way it stood. And so we just felt, it just didn't feel right. It doesn't feel right when you lose a child that's working, that there's nothing, that their life is worthless. And so that's our point for making an issue about this, is that I don't think that should happen to anyone else. You know, when their child, and it'll happen, maybe not the same circumstances, but there will be other single young people that are killed on the job. And I think that there's just a little bit more respect. Had she been found had injuries, whatever, that would have been taken care of. And it would seem to me that there should be an equality. And just because she's single, it shouldn't matter without dependents. And so that's what we're looking at. And then we just recently received a letter saying that they would like to publish that they had made a settlement with the Wilbergers in honor of her name, that they would like to make this. And that was rather offensive, so we're going to tell them we don't want our name listed in there. A settlement, I would guess people would think, oh, they received a huge amount of money or something. You know, it's kind of a slap in the face. To say that it was settled, you know, it was closed. But I just feel like there are some tweaks that need to be made to the system. And so that's basically it. And if you have any questions or anything.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to follow up with Ms. Wilberger, and I agree. I quite frankly don't see why there cannot be something like a life insurance policy that when a person dies on the job, in whatever manner, that, you know, they get $100,000, whether it's their family, their extended family, or whatever. But that's why it became very complicated, and then the statute is set up in a very complex way as well. So I just felt that Ms. Wilberger had raised a really interesting issue with me that had not been lost on me in the past, and I just could never find a way to get my hands around it. So I think this is one way that we can try to approach it and show some dignity and respect to these people whose lives are lost.
Okay, first, Senator Avakian.
It's actually a very, very important point. I'm really glad that you're here to talk about it. It's been, I don't know, Mr. Schultz would probably know, 100 years ago or better that we first started workers' compensation in Oregon. And the whole notion behind it was that you give up what would have been your right to claim damages in court in exchange for some type of guaranteed benefit. And you're tragically hitting on one area that in that exchange loses badly. And it isn't just with Brooke's loss. People who have parents that are working and providing for a family and die often don't get nearly what the value of that lost life is. And it's devastating for families. So I just thank you very much for coming here and bringing this up. It's very important. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. I first want to just say I'm very sorry for your loss. And your story it's much more than a little story. It's a very important story, and it informs why we are here. We are here to serve you. And thank you both for coming forward to talk about this and what the impact has been on you and your lives. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And I also want to thank you as constituents. It's one thing, it's always important to see people being part of the process and under the tragic situation that y'all have endured over the years and the unknowns and everything, and realizing that you're here really to try to make it better for the next individual family because of what you've suffered. I do have one question, though, Ms. Wilberger. Regarding the attorney fees, I'm assuming what they were willing to pay is what you, quote-unquote, incurred by bringing the action forward to try to get some recovery?
I feel really inept at this. I don't know what they were. We assume we didn't see them printed out.
No, I saw it. It was about $1,400, yeah. And it was the fees that reimbursed the attorney
right.
to bring it forward. Yeah. We didn't know how to do it,
right.
So we went to the attorney to ask them.
Right. And my understanding, and I could be corrected on this, I believe that those type of fees usually are going to be covered through the workers' comp claim if someone has been injured and they go through that process and it's not really out of pocket. So, your assessment of what you weren't getting versus what you got is pretty much right on.
Bye.
So, again, thank you very much for coming forward. Is there any other questions for
anyone
else?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have two other individuals that are asked to give testimony on this. John Schultz, why don't you come up first, and then we'll come back with Bill Clooning after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schiltz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 835. Just very quickly, the Workers' Compensation statute establishes specific benefit amounts for survivors of workers that die on the job as a result of their on-the-job injuries. And monthly benefits are provided to spouses deceased of the deceased worker, dependent children, other dependents, and the fatal benefits themselves are tied to the state's average weekly wage, with some annual cost of living increases that are paid by the Workers' Benefit Fund. In addition, the statute provides a burial benefit that is up to 10 times the Oregon average weekly wage. What this bill would do is require the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee to conduct an evaluation during this interim of the adequacy of the death benefits in the workers' compensation system here in Oregon. And the evaluation is to include reviewing the method of calculating the benefits, the burial benefit amount, the categories of the beneficiaries, and the feasibility of providing lump sum benefits as payments. Now, a written report would then be provided to the 75th Oregon Legislative Assembly. We agree this is important and it's timely. Other legislation was introduced last session regarding death benefits. There's been legislation introduced this session other than this bill, specifically by Representative Cannon, House Bill 2706. We've discussed this bill with Representative Cannon and believe that his issue, which is in regard to providing survivor benefits to parents, would be evaluated by this study. The Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee supports this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you'd have.
Questions for John? John, one question, I guess. Based on the date to report back to the legislature is January 31, 2009, which would be when we are in our next regular session. Will this be something that would be worked during the interim period? And if so, do you know how that work will be accomplished in the sense of some type of committee, subcommittee? Is the public going to be participating, or how's this going to work?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Management Labor Advisory Committee would typically form a subcommittee, which would be part of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and conduct public hearings where members of the public could provide input and testimony to the committee. We would act as the Department of Consumer and Business Services would act as staff to the Management Labor Advisory Committee and provide input as well. Something that I would see that we would be able to do is take a look at what some other states are doing and provide that as input, as well as assisting with individuals who want to get input into the committee but perhaps wouldn't be able to attend a meeting or something, be able to get that information to the committee. So, yes, it would be a likely first a subcommittee holding public hearings, and then they would make a recommendation to the full committee, which would also hold public hearings and to finish up the final recommendation and report, with the department providing staff support to the full committee.
Okay. And so the committee work itself, in the sense of the members, would be made up of the existing MLAC board or committee?
That would be my understanding, Mr. Chair, yes.
Do you know if these type of interim work groups, if they ever open up membership for people such as general public, or if the providers of workers' comp insurance, if they are part of the actual group that's working as a committee?
In my experience, Mr. Chair, the subcommittee or the full committee has typically been, and in my experience has always been, a Management Labor Advisory Committee members, but members of the public or insurers or whoever want to are provided with quite a bit of opportunity to address the committee.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I'm not reading that this language of this bill predetermines any outcome. Would that be accurate, or does this imply there will be an outcome that increases or decreases anything?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think you're absolutely correct. There is no predetermined outcome from this evaluation, other than that there would be a report provided. But in terms of recommendations, that would come from the findings of the evaluation itself.
Okay. All right. John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's see, Bill Cluning, why don't you come on up? And is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 835?
Thank you, Chair Posnanski. Committee, for the record, Bill Cluning, Carpenters Industrial Workers. Committee, I spent almost 40 years in a milling timber mill, and tragically we lost three employees. Things like this should never happen, but they did. I just spent last weekend reading the biannual report from the Workman's Comp, where we're at nationwide. It's a pretty thick manual. What I determined was that, and luckily, we're in the top 10 as far as the cost for the employers. And that's a good thing. But I could not find where we rank across the nation as far as the death benefit of a worker. I would like to see at least we wind up in the top 10 in the nation as far as a death benefit to the survivor, to the family of a deceased worker. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 835, open our work session on Senate Bill 835. And if I could have a motion, there's no amendments on this one, is that correct?
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 835 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer moves Senate Bill 835 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, I assume you want to carry this one?
I do, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 835. Andrew the Wilbergers, again, thank you very much for coming up today. And we're going to move into a new public hearing. I'm going to open up a public hearing now on Senate Bill 253. Okay. And on Senate Bill 253, Chris, hi, how are you doing? Chris Moore will be opening up, and looks like you're the only one that signed up at this point. And we'll see if anyone else wants to supplement what you have to say.
Good afternoon, Chair Posnanski and members of the committee. My name is Chris Moore. I'm an attorney from Eugene. I practice primarily representing injured workers. I'm here on behalf of my law firm and the Working Travelers Association to urge support of Senate Bill 253. I'll spend as much time as you want or as little time as you want trying to explain this situation beginning in 1990.
Well, I'll tell you what, before we do that, I'm going to get in trouble if I don't stop you just for a second. I should have let Anna give us the overview, and then I'm going to redirect you back to your testimony. And it looks like you're here in support of not only for 235 but for the Dash 2s.
That's correct.
So we're going to get a little bit of overview just to put this on the record, and then we'll come right back. Sorry, Chris.
No problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 953 allows administrative law judge who mediates a workers' compensation claim to improve an agreement between the parties. There is a Dash 2 amendment, and the Dash 2 amendment, from what I understand, deletes Section 4 of the bill, which tried to get at the situation where the mediator was not an employee of the Workers' Compensation Division. There's no revenue impact. I do not have a fiscal impact statement information yet, but I do not expect one because it seems like a streamlining bill.
Okay.
I did note that the chair of the Workers' Comp Board is here, and if you had questions about the fiscal, you could probably ask her.
Okay.
Just by way of a little background, the claim disposition agreement is what amounts to a compromise and release of the non-medical rights that a worker has in a claim, and it is a means of settling those rights. Mediations are settlement conferences that take significant chunks of the day and frequently result in resolution of the case, sometimes just with a claim disposition agreement, sometimes with both a disputed claim settlement, which is a resolution of a denied portion of the claim that resolves that entire aspect of the claim, as well as a claim disposition agreement. Under current law, when a claim disposition agreement is submitted to the Workers' Compensation Board for approval, only the board can sign the claim disposition agreement. Sometimes the when two documents are sent, there can be some confusion or some delay in getting both documents signed as quickly as possible. What this bill does is to alter that in one instance, and that is when there is a mediation and the mediator is an employee of the Workers' Compensation Board, then that employee of the Workers' Compensation Board, that mediator, can sign the claim disposition agreement rather than having that signed only by the Workers' Compensation Board. It's our belief that this will expedite the getting the settlement documents approved. The Workers' Compensation Board has laid out what the law is with regard to what types of claim disposition agreements can be approved, what things cannot be approved. And frankly, most of that law is now 15 years old, and it's pretty well established. There are not a lot of controversies in that regard. But we wanted to make sure that we have people who are very well versed in the workers' comp law who are going to sign the claim disposition agreement. The parties can agree to have anyone mediate their case, and they do hire people from outside the workers' comp system to mediate. Those people will not be able to sign the claim disposition agreement. The Dash 2 amendments, as written, would have required, Section 4 of the bill as written would have required that the Workers' Compensation Board, in all instances other than one involving a mediation, sign both the disputed claim settlement and the claim disposition agreement, rather than current practice where the board signs the claim disposition agreement and sends any other documents to an administrative law judge to sign. And we wanted to remove that because current practice is working fine in the vast majority of cases. The one exception, as I say, was in a mediation where we thought we could expedite matters. Initially, there had been some concern about having a non-employee mediate a case and could they end up signing one or more of the documents. And the rest of the statute is so explicit about administrative law judge who mediates the case must be an employee that we didn't think there's any realistic possibility that someone would believe that a non-employee would sign either of the documents. And so we wanted to leave a little more discretion for the Workers' Comp Board when there's no mediation as to where the documents go.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Moore?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
A couple questions. You said this is intended to make sure we eliminate delays in the system when there's agreements. What is the average delay? I guess how often does the board meet now? And so, what is the average delay we're trying to take care of?
Typically, I can't answer the questions about how the board functions internally. As I indicated earlier, the board chair is here, and she could probably answer those questions better than I could. But typically, it's taking 7 to 10 days from the time we submit a document to the Workers' Compensation Board to get it signed. Please don't misunderstand me. That's generally speaking, it's not a big problem. But sometimes, and particularly in cases that are mediated, which can be very complex, I just did one on Friday on Thursday that lasted from 9:30 until 5:30. And at the end, we were writing down what the agreement was to have everyone sign off on that. But it's not binding on anyone until it ultimately gets approved. And sometimes it can make a big difference for both of the parties to be able to say, this is exactly our agreement. We've spent 8 hours going through this, and we'd like to have closure today, and we'd be able to do that. So, as I say, 7 to 10 days is usually what we see, or at least usually what I see. I can't speak for anyone else.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The bill, as I read it, is permissive. It allows the administrative law judge to approve agreements. It doesn't require them to. And so why, first, I guess, a two-part question, why allow instead of require? And second, are there reasons that an administrative law judge would not approve that you can think of?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, to answer the second part of your question first, yes, there are circumstances under which an administrative law judge or the Workers' Compensation Board would not approve a claim disposition agreement. And therefore, the allow rather than require means that they have to conduct an evaluation of the agreement. They can't approve the agreement if it's unreasonable as a matter of law. That's currently written into statute. They could not approve a claim disposition agreement as an example. They could not approve one that purported to resolve medical issues, which by statute can't be resolved by a claim disposition agreement. So they are required to make the same analysis that the Workers' Compensation Board makes about whether they're going to approve it or not. And then, having made that decision, they would presumably approve it unless there was a problem with it, in which case they would disapprove it and say, send it back to the parties and say, this particular clause is illegal or is not something I can approve.
It just seems like if they're the ones doing the mediation of this agreement, they should have known that before they said it was the final.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, they would. But the statute requires that the board, and therefore would require that the administrative law judge, conduct that same analysis, make sure that the document is legal, and they would approve it if it is legal. Rather, people make mistakes. There can be drafting errors.
Okay. That just seems kind of redundant.
Yeah. Any other questions, Mr. Moore? Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 253? Not seeing any, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 253. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 253, knowing that we have the dash twos. And my understanding, and looking at what's on the dash twos, it would remove the new section 4 on page 2 and just restore the numbering that was already in place. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Byer, do you feel comfortable giving us a motion on the dash twos?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to dash two amendments.
Senator Byer moves the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 253. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, just a question before we move the bill. I don't know if this should go to MLAC or not, but has it gone to MLAC?
It has gone to MLAC, and they have approved it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 253 to the floor. I think with a due pass recommendation. I guess I'll wait until we accept the motion before he's saying as amended.
As amended. And I accept the motion as presented. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I support it. It just seems like the wording of this is a little bit cumbersome. I think it could have been drafted better, and I don't know if the House, it probably gets you to where you want to go, but it just seems like it's kind of redundant to say that the same person who mediated it then finds out something's wrong with it. Well, he should have known that while he was mediating it, or she, while they were mediating it.
Right.
So anyway, that's a comment.
Okay. Any other comments? Any objection to the motion to move Senate Bill 253 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation? Be so ordered. Thank you. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 253. And that means that we're now going to open up one on public hearing on Senate Bill 917. And Anna, why don't you give us the overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 917 requires an inventory of work injured worker's medical records to be given to the worker within 10 days of a receipt of a medical record relating to a worker's compensation claim. It creates a rebuttable presumption for the validity of the record as described by a doctor or injured worker in support of the claim if the record is lost, and it authorizes the Department of Consumer Service and Business Services to investigate the loss of the record and assess penalties. I have a -1 amendment on your desk, and I received it this afternoon, and I have not been able to analyze it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So we've got Ed Johnston here to give testimony on 914, and just for the record, 917, excuse me, and just for the record, Brian, I will carry the last bill that we passed, which was 253.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnston from Lincoln County. Most of you are somewhat familiar with me and a little bit of my workman's comp case. I'm the proponent of this bill, which frustrates me. In 1989, I was a bouncer at a nightclub, and I ended up getting essentially my neck broken on the job. May 31st, 1990, the insurance company totally disabled me. I was waiting for surgery. I was anticipating and waiting for surgery. At that point, there were some medical records that were disappeared. 1992, I was ordered to go back to work with two discs and a spinal cord, which I did. For several years, I went through excruciating pain, and beside that working, I was sued over the bills from the hospital, and I still been paying most of my own medical as well as my own prescription cost. And what frustrates me is that I have gone through this. In 1998, I finally ended up with the first surgery after almost attempting suicide, because at that point the disc was in my spinal cord. I was such an excruciating pain that I was getting nowhere, and so I got to the point where I went to take my own life. 4 days after that, I finally received the authorization for surgery, which I finally went in on March 3rd of 1998 for the first surgery. In that, the insurance company was asked by my doctor, dealing with the total circumstances of the injury, that they should do both discs 4-5 and 5-6. It was part of the original injury. The insurance company, Liberty Northwest, at that point decided that they were not going to cover that. They would cover 4-5, but not cover 5-6, but they wouldn't cover 4-5. So that disc was allowed to continue to protrude in my spinal cord. It was not a complete surgery. And I lived 6 years with this pain, going through this, working full-time. And in the community, thank God, the community in my area, you know, I was able to get a job as a cook, and the people worked with me. They understood. They knew what was going on with the circumstance. Dealing with after the first surgery, I was sent back to work again by the insurance company, knowing that I had 4-5 discs in the spinal cord. I went back to work. I got re-injured on the job in the kitchen because of wet floors. Put 4-5 into the spinal cord completely at that point. Put it down to 4 millimeters. So I had to go back for another surgery that they had to retake out the discs, the plates of my neck, and take out 4-5 and to basically do the surgery they should have done originally. That would actually should have been done in 1992. So I've gone through a lot of frustration in this, and I didn't prepare anything. I'm used to shooting on a hip because I haven't. It's been very a trying situation with all this situation of an injured worker. This was not, I believe, an isolated situation. I like to get into, because of my political views, as you notice, you'll have an Inspector General's report in front of you. This is from Social Security. This is dealing with my local and public officials. Because of my political voice, as some knows, that sometimes I have a different attitude of how to deal with some things compared to being more subtle, as sometimes I should be. Well, because of my political views and dealing with going after the insurance company, 4 years ago when they were doing Measure 38, I was a Citizens Against Measure 38, brought the evidence out, dealing with that they lost and destroyed medical records. In 03, when I went in for back after the other surgery for more MRIs, the insurance company misplaced, I'll say it that way, several MRIs and x-rays. The technician at the time was able to reproduce those MRIs and x-rays because they were able, at that point, had a memory chip, so they were able to reproduce it. Prior to that, all the worsening condition after the second surgery that was all started from this. Now I have 12 blown discs, 4 in the spinal cord, beside the closed head injury. That is all on record, and I'm still fighting all this today. Liberty Northwest, dealing with the Inspector General report with my former police chief, because he was indicted with standards and practices, was involved. He had an insurance company with his family. Apparently, they had a lot to deal with Liberty Northwest. I haven't finished getting all this information, but it ties Liberty Northwest into the Inspector General report, because my former employer with Liberty filed against us with Social Security, saying my disability was a fraud. And my medical records have been stated, and nothing has changed in my condition. It is going downhill. The one thing is I had a lot of several good doctors with this case that stood by my side, and Dr. Bernstein was one of the original doctors that told me what my living conditions would be within 20 years of this spinal injury, which it is going in that direction. I've talked to many doctors over the years that a lot of them said that doctors shouldn't tell you these things about your condition. You know, and I respect the ones that do this to their patients. And there should be nothing that should inhibit them from telling the factual truth or the best of their knowledge of their medical expertise of the condition. I am on somewhat of a downhill slope, and it is to be expected because the amount of disc I have blown with a closed head injury, and also two I wanted to add into with the lung conditions that I have with the spinal cord, the disc in the spinal cord, as I was told by many doctors, plausibly dealing with your spinal cord, that would have effect on your lungs. So, I mean, I'm dealing with a lot of issues, and because of this, I'm financially devastated because of this situation. I have lost my family directly because of this situation. And also, too, dealing with this politically and locally with the Inspector General report, where hopefully it will come out because I have an attorney that did file a tort claim with the city of Toledo. But I found out in 2001 I was supposed to get Social Security, which I never received because the local political influences, you can sort of say, stop that. Because in my community, I do have a large mouth, as some might say, and I've gone for many issues, against many issues in the state, in my opinion, strongly. So I've been personally attacked in that. And, you know, it's just living through this, and when you go through the trauma and the situation of this and losing your family when you're supposed to have some type of income. And the one thing that frustrates me and the reason why I put the $100 a day penalty in this with the insurance company, it disturbs me that the insurance company could pass me off as an injured worker to the taxpayers. What frustrates me when I've read some of the insurance bills going 1917 on up, that was not the case of the insurance companies to do that. And now we are passing the buck back to the taxpayers. And that's why we allowed the insurance companies at the beginning to do this so there wouldn't be the burden on the taxpayers. And right now we're doing a full circle, and that's what frustrates me and the loss of families that are going on because of this. And it destroyed, you know, 3 kids mentally of what happened, and including with personal attacks with my local situation, because when I recalled the school board, it was a lot of personal attacks that they did to the kids from the school. We were harassed by the police department. I have been pulled over numerous times at gunpoint. My life has been threatened in that manner. I do have a videotape of November 14th, 2005 of arrest dealing with.
Ed, I'm going to ask you to focus on the
bill,
on the bill, and specifically on the amendments. You got the dash one,
yes,
which I assume they were drafted at your request.
Yes,
we just received them, so we don't have an analysis. So why don't you give us some focus on that, and then we can proceed from there.
Okay. Well, one thing I would like to add: last week, dealing with the city of Toledo, we've gone through a lot of frustration. But our mayor of Toledo, Sharon Branster, last week, what I understand, had a major heart attack and triple bypass surgery, and so I like to do, even though we have our differences of opinion, I would publicly like to say I give her the blessings that she pulls through with all this. Dealing with the amendments that I have gone through, with that, with the MRIs and x-rays and the audio recordings, and that I have asked many times to audio record hearings or information, and I'm told that I cannot do that. And I believe with the, when I was at the job, there was a videotape of me when I was injured. That videotape was given to Liberty Northwest Insurance Company. That videotape disappeared from record. I have requested that copy of that when we were trying to go to Workman's Comp, and Liberty Northwest said they don't know what we're talking about, even though that they had receipt of the tape, but they don't know where it went. And so when it comes down to those, that type of record, I know that they have misplaced, or I would say destroyed, records. And so when you request that, when they have it in their possession, you should be able to retain this.
Right.
And, I mean, I'm still getting new at this. I'm still basically in diapers when it comes to this. I'll publicly admit to that one. I'm still learning a lot on this. But the one thing that I want to get into, like the $100 a day penalty, that was the one frustration that I've heard for several people on that. And because of the structure of the financial devastation that I have gone through, and because of family, who has, a lot of family has helped me out to a degree, but they're burned out helping me out dealing with this because, you know, 15 years later, nothing's done. Basically, you know, my family has basically for many years said that went against me because of letters and stuff they received. Because I was faking it is what turned out that they were claiming, but in reality I was not faking it. So with the penalties on $100 a day on that, because of the devastation I've lost, I'm thousands and thousands of dollars in debt for something on a job injury that I did not do to myself. And I guess I could see if somebody went out and did it to themselves, but I was injured on a job, not of my own recourse. So I think because of that and the loss that we go through, because there's no making up to it. And then when you get put onto the system, as I've been put on the system, you know, taking a more drain on the system, to me that is very frustrating, and that should not be placed on the taxpayers when we have an insurance structure that we're paying for that is supposed to take that burden off the taxpayers, to the best of my understanding, what I've read and the research I've done.
All right. Questions for Mr. Johnson? Not seeing any. All right, so I think what we're going to do, Ed, on this is that I'm going to first see if anyone else wants to give testimony today, but if not, then we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We'll allow our staff, Ms. Braun, to go through the amendments and give us a overview of where we're at, and we'll decide at that point what would be the next step.
I appreciate that. Excuse me, a little bit of frustration because, you know, I'm still dealing with a lot of pain, and it's one thing that severe chronic pain patients have a tendency of dealing with, and sometimes people don't know how to deal with that. And sometimes, even with people on my side to deal with severe chronic pain, we're still trying to deal with it, so it doesn't show all the time. So,
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate.
All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 917? Not seeing anyone come forward. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 917. And, Anna, what else do we have on the agenda for today?
That's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much.
Before I adjourn, is there anything else anyone in the committee needs to say or want to say? If not, then we'll stay tuned. We'll see everyone on Wednesday. And we're closed for the day.